Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's fiction podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. For this podcast, Jim Fusilli reads his story, The One-Armed Man in the Luncheonette, which appeared in the June 2014 issue of the magazine. Jim Fusilli is a rock and pop critic for the Wall Street Journal. He also writes about music on his blog, renewmusic.net, and is the author of the critical work, The Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. In addition, he is a novelist and short story writer. His most recent novel is Billboard Man, a thriller featuring a nameless drifter who first appeared in The Road to Nowhere. His story, Digby, Attorney at Law, was shortlisted for both an Edgar and McCavity Award in 2010. Like Digby, Attorney at Law, The One-Armed Man in the Luncheonette takes place in the fictional town of Narrows Gate, which is based on Jim's hometown of Hoboken, New Jersey.
Looking back, it seemed like it was meant to be, meeting like that, a gust of wind, her hat tumbling onto the tar-coated ties of the elevated tracks. He jumped down to get it, a man in a red flannel shirt, patched slacks, and blistered shoes. "Here you go," he said as he dusted it on his forearm, the train wheezing into the station. They spent an hour on a bench, trains passing by, people off, people on. My life went like this. Oh, my life went like that, too. Twilight arrived. The conversation dribbled to silence. "Well, I'd better be." "Yeah, me too, I guess." By the time she returned to Jackson Heights, she was thinking, "What in the world?" Next afternoon, he was waiting by the stairs when she arrived, token in her hand, her little after-school job done for the day. He wore his only suit. "I'm a long way from home," he said, "and I've been riding the subway trying to find my place. At least now I know the Bronx is up, the Battery down." The man from Kentucky was lanky, long-faced. His Adam's apple jutted out over the knot in his wide floral tie. He was thinking she had the biggest eyes this side of Betty Boop, and nobody that pretty ought to be sad. "Trudy, might you know where I can find me some work? This depression put me off my stride." Her first thought was, if he didn't mind starting at the bottom, he ought to go after the last job her father drank away. "I'm good with cars," he added. He talked himself into a job out in the auto graveyard in Willets Point. She graduated, they married, and for a while it looked like they were going to be fine. They went to a picture show now and then, and shortly after they buried her father, they learned they had some insurance money coming in, enough for a couple of nightstands and a chest of drawers. With what was left over, Fred bought Trudy a new dress, holding up a clipping as he ventured into S. Klein in Union Square. "Fred?" she asked, her eyes warm with surprise, as she opened the box. While he was at work, she took out a sewing kit and got the hem just right. She turned in front of the mirror. She hadn't dared to think they could go places, do things, but here she was, sparkling and new. She tried on a smile. As she slid the dress onto a hanger, the phone rang down the hall. Wrestling into her robe, she shuffled in her slippers to answer it. "You've got to hurry," a man with an Italian accent told her. "It don't look so good." Fred's arm was yanked right out of its socket and swallowed up by the machine. She was wearing the new dress when the doctor told her she was one lucky woman. There was a chance he'd be all right. You never know what you can do until you have to. "Not a lot of work for a one-armed mechanic," he said, clutching the one ads. It had taken him 8 months to recuperate fully, the wound still puffy and pink. She was back behind the counter at Schraff's, doling out bonbons and coconut squares. They had enough to get by. They hadn't had to sell the dress yet, or the new furniture. People stared at the one-armed man. "Maybe I can get a job at this World's Fair they intend to build," he said, as he walked her to the subway station. It was a few years away, but she said, "Why not?" He was learning to write with his left hand. They wanted to give him a contraption that strapped around his chest and what remained of his shoulder. It ended with a hook. They told him he could get it to maneuver so good he could pick up a dime. "No, thank you." She'd taken the commercial track in high school, so the business books she borrowed at the library spoke in a familiar language. Ideas began to take root, but she wavered. Sitting on the fire escape outside their cold water flat, cranes swaying freight at the shipyards. As she suspected it might, Fred's wherewithal had withered. He was a shell now, lost to unspoken thoughts and dreamless. They hadn't been man and wife since he lost his arm. "Fred, why don't you let me take care of you?" she asked, as another joyless dinner wound down. "It's a wife's duty." "When it's by choice," he said, looking up from his soup bowl. Winter was coming, and he was washing dishes at a run-down luncheonette on Junction Boulevard, working hard so it didn't feel like charity. Mr. Colonaris, the owner, was recovering from a stroke, his lips sagging at the corner, leg dragging. And one afternoon, his son Nemo, a sour SOB, came to the sullen dishwasher and told him he ought to learn how to work the griddle, seeing as you only need one arm to operate a spatula, all right, or crack an egg. Fred shrugged, but he agreed to try. Trudy watched as he practiced at home. He took to it, and soon the luncheonette hummed with industry. Service improved. Prepared with care, the food tasted better. How about that one-arm cook? You seen him toss the spatula in the air, crack two eggs, and then catch it on the way down? The way he slices vegetables, rat-a-tat-tat, like some sort of machine. Now and then a customer applauded. The story traveled, and soon the Daily News arrived. Reporter and photographer. "One-armed man cooks up a storm," read the headline. A big photo. Fred, spatula in his fist, liver and onions frying nearby. The quiet, awkward man from Kentucky was a neighborhood celebrity for a few days. People looked at him a bit different, thinking he had something they missed. Mr. Clonaris died in his chair in the luncheonette storeroom. Before the body was hauled off, the son Nemo said he was going to shut it down. He had no interest in the business. Zero. It was a stone around his neck. Feed people and clean up after them? Forget that, chum. Trudy came up with an idea. Fred should offer to buy. Here's how we'll do it. They visited Clonaris at home. In the living room, hat on his knees, Fred recited Trudy's script. "Transfer the mortgage and we'll pay it off. Plus give you 2 cents on the dollar after expenses for 1 year." "Good riddance," thought Nemo Clonaris as the paper was signed. His wife, daughter of a disgraced ex-cop named Mulvaney, told him he got took, but he didn't care. As long as he didn't have to set foot ever again in that grease pit. In time, the Daily News came back. Why not? A success story. People enjoyed a happy tale now and then. A one-armed man runs the junction, a profitable luncheonette. Come on, fellas, quit your griping and get back to work. Trudy did the books at home, a cash business. Now she was welcomed at the Chemical Bank and Trust. One evening, as she tallied the day's take, she proposed a reinvestment program. "Don't make it too swell," Fred advised, as he poured Epsom salts into a basin. "You'll chase away our best customers." "Okay, Fred," she said, stacking dimes. Not long after the junction was first featured in the Daily News, Nemo Colonaris was summoned to his boss's office. The Fuller Brush Company, Mr. Slezak solemnly said, was closing its Manhattan branch. All purchasing would be managed out of Hartford. "I'd be glad to put in a good word for you," he offered, though he knew well his employees' insufficiencies. "You want me to move to Hartford?" Clarice replied. "Like hell I will." Soon he was pushing bolts of fabric along 6th Avenue, rain or shine, for less than he made at his first job after he'd eked his way out of high school. Clarice calculated. He concluded not a damn thing had gone right since his father died, and he sold the luncheonette for far less than it was now worth. Lacking the gift of introspection, and willing to see recent events as part of a lifelong continuum of self-induced failure, he blamed Fred for his fall. Not an unexpected deduction. Undisciplined and inexplicably smug, Clonaris was a petty schemer who was convinced the straight path was for imbeciles only. But now he'd begun to realize he would be stuck at his station. No windfall was ever coming his way. Said Heidi Mulvaney Clonaris, fist on hip, words rank with disdain, "You're hapless. You know that, right? You're no one's idea of a man. Look at you. Why I married you, I'll never know. 24 years, and what do I have to show for it? Nothing." Convinced he had been swindled by Trudy's proposal, he contacted an attorney. He wanted the luncheonette. It had been stolen from him in his hour of grief. "You have no case, Mr. Clonaris," the attorney replied after examining the contract. "To be honest, if they're making as much money as you claim, I applaud their initiative." Clonaris stormed home, where bile and vitriol were waiting. An officer at the Chemical Bank had attended DeWitt Clinton with Grover Whalen, president of the New York World's Fair Committee. He had a thought. Perhaps it's nothing, but... Whalen called it a fine idea. Without fanfare, he and the bank officer visited the busy luncheonette. It was bright and inviting and immaculate. tidy in suits and ties, men from storefront businesses on nearby Northern Boulevard, sat at the new tables and booths in back, while the regulars nested on swiveling stools. Fred hustled at the grill and worked the counter, gliding as if he were on roller skates. Twin sisters, portly emigres from Poland, took care of the patrons in the dining room, stacking plates along the crooks of their meaty arms. "You ought to see him cook up a grilled cheese sandwich," the bank officer whispered to Whalen. The World's Fair president ordered the Salisbury steak and whipped potatoes. A half hour later, as he dabbed below his dapper mustache, he judged the meal excellent, as was the workers' bustle and abundant good cheer. Several days later, the banker arranged for Trudy to meet with a member of Whalen's staff, who presented with flip charts and storyboards. In addition to the food zone, with its pavilions featuring products by Beech Nut, Seal Test, Standard Brands, the National Biscuit Company, and so forth, and the restaurant in the Hall of Nations, concession stands would be sprinkled throughout the fair. Perhaps the Junction Luncheonette would add local flavor to the global enterprise. The committee's lone caveat: her husband would have to work the stand. "Fred, it's not like that," Trudy said later when he protested. "Of course it's good publicity for the fair, but..." "Come see the one-armed man," he said. "Watch as he flips pancakes and plays the Jew's harp." She sighed. She rose with him at 4 o'clock to take it up again, but during the night Fred had seen the bright side. Hat in hand, he apologized for doubting her counsel. Meeting again with Whalen's staff, this time in Manhattan, Trudy negotiated rates for space that were lower than what Coca-Cola and Orange Crush were to pay. An agreement was reached quickly. On schedule to open next April, the fair, The World of Tomorrow, was a daily presence in New York's newspaper. Every article brimmed with unbridled enthusiasm and civic cheerleading. The tale of the one-armed chef and the once-struggling Junction Luncheonette spoke to the indomitability of mankind, one of the fair's themes. At Whalen's urgings, reporters and photographers flocked to Jackson Heights. In short order, the Daily Mirror, the Herald Tribune, the Journal American, the World Telegram, and of course the Daily News, ran features about Fred, Trudy, and the Junction. One evening, after H.V. Kaltenborn's dramatic report from Munich on the CBS radio network, a look at the lighter side. A Kentucky man, born to a home without electricity or running water, is now the toast of New York City. That was the last straw for Kalarnis. He'd been beaten by a yokel, a hillbilly, a fry cook. He retrieved his father's pistol, the only object he'd taken from the luncheonette before its sale. That evening, as they strolled the boulevard, Trudy suggested they open the Junction for a dinner crowd. As she anticipated, Fred protested. "We start at 6, and after 3 we're a ghost town," he said without rancor. "I don't see the sense of it." Trudy walked on his right side, leaving his left arm free to use as necessary. Given his renown, he had cause to tip his hat to a friendly greeting at least once per block. Everybody knew Fred, the one-armed man on the luncheonette. Everyone liked him, too. "You want me out of your hair from dawn till midnight," he said. "Says something about the kind of marriage we got going on." She knew he was teasing. "Well, of course," she replied. "If I have to, I'll agree to another man coming to work the night shift." "At the Junction?" he asked. She jabbed him with an elbow. There was no need. Fred was never crude. Her father swore with each sentence, but Fred never did. "I was raised respectful," he explained. Earlier, after they signed the agreement with the World's Fair Committee, they settled on a plan. When the fair closed in late 1940, they'd have their first child, and then another as quickly as they could. They'd work hard, and they knew they could provide. Now, in the sway of an autumn breeze, Fred said, "Let's see what kind of foot traffic we get at supper time on a night like this." They circled back toward the Junction. Clonaris was waiting. He'd done so little reconnaissance that he was unaware that the Junction closed hours ago. And yet here was the one-armed man walking his way, his wife too, panting. Clarnus watched as Fred unlocked the door and held it open. Trudy entered and snapped the wall switch. Fluorescent lights hissed and flickered before flooding the luncheonette with light. Clarnus stepped around the panel truck he'd been using as a shield, but before he could cross the sidewalk, a man entered the Junction. "Freddy!" the man shouted. Even though it was unseasonably warm, Silverstein was dressed for snow, galoshes even. "You're opening at night now?" Fred, who out of habit now stood behind the counter, said no. "Not open, sorry." Silverstein, who worked in the jewelry district on the Bowery, said, "But the lights are on, and there you are." "Mr. Silverstein," said Trudy, "the griddle is cold." "Kaput?" Until 6 o'clock tomorrow, Fred said. Save me an egg, Silverstein told him as he exited. Fred noticed a tiny speck on the grill. He withdrew the spatula to scrape it free. Colonardus burst in, his father's weapon in plain view. Fred, Trudy said. Get behind the counter, Colonardus told her, waving the pistol. Mister, Fred said. He nodded towards the cash register. Its drawer was open and empty. Mister, Colonardus said. By now, Trudy was at Fred's side. She said, is that you? Nemo? Nemo Colonardus? Neither Fred nor Trudy recognized him. He had gained weight and hadn't shaved or bathed for days. For a moment, Fred thought Colonardus looked like Bluto in the Popeye funnies. Mr. Colonardus, Fred said, what is this? It's my chance to get even. Trudy said she didn't understand. Get even? Meanwhile, on Northern Boulevard, a small crowd gathered. People rushing home from work, a man walking his dog, three girls from PS 148. In the stark light shining through the bay window, Fred recognized them. And of course they knew Fred, the one-armed man and their luncheonette. What you have, Clonaris said, belongs to me. No, sir, said Fred. We've done you fair and square. It's a binding contract, Trudy answered. She held her hands high like in the movie pictures. We worked for it. That was Fred, who held the spatula in his fist. No, said Clonaris as he raised the pistol. Out on the boulevard, a woman screamed. Scrambling to stand in front of each other, Fred and Trudy bumped together and bounced apart. Clonaris moved his arm until the pistol was pointed at Trudy. He squeezed the trigger. A bullet flew. Fred reached across his body to shove Trudy aside, the spatula still in his hand. Clonaris squeezed again and again and again, but now the gun was jammed. The crowd rushed in and knocked Clonaris to the terrazzo tile. Silverstein knelt on his chest. Fred and Trudy looked at each other. Neither had been hit by the lone bullet. Spatula saves wife, screamed the Daily News, though eyewitnesses reported it as fact, leading to the newspaper's headline. It wasn't so. Clonaris missed the shot, and by a wide margin. The bullet lodged above the grill. After hours, Fred took spackle to the hole and a fresh coat of paint to the wall. Shortly before its takeover by the Union Carbide and Carbon Company, the Bakelite Corporation offered Fred a stipend if he were to appear on the radio and recommend its kitchen utensils. Grover Whaling, seeking maximum mileage out of any publicity that could be associated with the World's Fair, encouraged his former classmate to endorse Trudy for a managerial post at the local chemical bank and trust branch. Even as Colonaris was convicted swiftly and sentenced to prison, offers continued to mount. Fred and Trudy declined every one. Hard work had secured their future. They had each other and the luncheonette, and soon there would be children. Who could want for anything more?
Thank you, Jim, for that reading. That was Jim Fusilli reading his 2014 story, The One-Armed Man in the Luncheonette. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, which is published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. To learn more about us, visit our website, themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand, and digital versions are available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Magster, Sony, and Google Play. Thanks to Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty for their help in producing our podcast, and thank you for listening.